Chapter 8. Author's Notes. This chapter is somewhat triggery for torture, dehumanization, panic attacks, claustrophobia, generally me being a horrible person to Styles. By the time the sun sets, they've gone from being in the middle of nowhere to being in a different part of the middle of nowhere. Their scenery has barely changed. The mountains on the horizon don't look any different. It's discouraging, to say the least. Lydia estimates that they've walked between 25 and 30 miles. Naturally, they haven't seen another living soul. Planes have flown over a few times, but too high to see them, even if they wave and shout. "They must be looking for us by now," Erica says, after the third plane they see. "Yeah," Styles agrees, "but that doesn't mean they'll find us." He has faith in his pack and in his father. He's less afraid than he probably should be. It's one of those things that he just can't muster up an emotional response for. He always does this to a certain degree. Locks down any sort of freakout he wants to have or even should have. Deals with the problem. And then has a delayed reaction breakdown. It's probably not the healthiest way of coping, but it works. Once the light has faded from the sky, it becomes clear that they won't be able to travel at night. The moon is almost new, and the stars don't provide enough light to see by. The wolves had some limited night vision, but that only takes them so far. And Styles, of course, has normal human vision. "Let's try to build a fire," Styles says. "Maybe a plane or something will see it." The others agree, but it's a lot easier said than done. There's pretty much no vegetation. They've seen a few scraggly tufts of grass over the course of the day, but that's all. They have their spare clothes, which are flammable enough, but won't burn for more than a few minutes. Salt does burn. Styles knows this from a kitchen mishap. So they dig up a section of the desert and shred some cloth into it, before using some matches that Styles carries in his bag of random crap. "Forget it, guys," Lydia says after a few minutes of effort. "I just don't think it's going to happen." She shares out more food. They finish the sandwiches. They won't be good after today, so there's no point in hanging onto them. They split another orange and take a few sips of water. Everyone presses him into taking a few extra swallows. They can tolerate dehydration and deprivation better than he can, they remind him. That's all well and good, but he's grimly aware that with what they have, they can't last more than 2 or 3 more days. That thought is still rolling around in his head when he curls up on the hard ground, rests his head on Derek's flank, and drifts off to sleep. It turns out not to matter at all. They've set up watches, of course, but nobody sees the attack coming. The ground suddenly starts to shake. All of them bolt to their feet. "Stay together," Styles shouts, as the world begins to heave around them. He stumbles into Derek, who grabs him and steadies him. Then he sees the light on the horizon. Headlights. "I hear engines," Derek says. "Big ones. Trucks, maybe." Any sort of vehicle would be able to cross the salt flats without issue. Styles takes a moment to consider their options, only to realize that they have none. They could run, but there's nowhere to go, and they can't outrun cars on open ground. The obvious option of stand-and-fight is basically suicide. They're undoubtedly going to be outnumbered, and although they're not completely weaponless, it's close. The only weapon he brought with him is his .38, and he only has one spare clip. He can't fight off an army with that. They could surrender. That's an option he considers briefly before shoving it aside. He doesn't know whether these people intend to capture them or kill them, but there's too good a chance that they'd be slaughtered where they stood. In a few seconds, he decides that running is their best option. They can't all make it, but maybe one or two of them can, and they can try to get help to the others. "Everyone, turn your phone on so we'll be able to locate your GPS if you wind up in a place with signal," he says, in a rapid voice. "And then run. We'll split into pairs and go in opposite directions. Boyd, Erica, Danny, Lydia, and Derek with me. Got it? Go! Go! Everyone takes off. Styles hastily clambers onto Derek's back, since he can't run anywhere near as fast as the werewolf. And he takes off at a dead sprint. It's a good plan, and one he's pretty proud of coming up with in such dire straits. The hunters will have to split up to follow them, so maybe some of them can get away, or be able to fight off a smaller group. He and Derek can take on as many as a dozen, maybe, or at least slow them down enough to get away. He's actually starting to think that it might not be a total disaster when the desert ground ripples again and a huge chunk of it just starts to rise, a wall erupting from solid ground right in front of them. It happens too fast for Derek to check his momentum, and he slams into it at almost full speed and then collapses backwards. "Derek? Derek!" Styles says, squirming out from underneath him. The werewolf gives a growling groan, the bones in his face creaking as they start to repair themselves. Styles crouches over him and pulls out his .38, but he doesn't see anyone coming towards them. The ground gives another shake, and then four walls erupt out of the desert floor, enclosing him in utter darkness. "No!" Styles shouts, slamming his fists into the hard ground. He can feel his stomach rising into his throat and presses the claustrophobia back down. He forces himself to steady his hands and ready his gun for when the walls come down. But they don't. He can hear the earth shifting, moving, but he isn't sure what's happening until he hears an engine. They're putting him on the truck, still in the cube. "Derek," he whispers, shaking the half-conscious werewolf. "Derek, wake up. Get us out of here." "Fuck," Derek groans, and manages to sit up. Styles can hear him pounding his fists against the earth. An interminable amount of time passes by before he finally says, "Jesus, it's no good. That's harder than granite." It shouldn't be," Styles says, feeling panic close in. "Salt is actually very fragile. The earth should be crumbly. It should still be on the desert floor, but it isn't there either," Derek says waspishly, but then his voice softens. Hey, come here." He gathers Styles into his arms, feeling the way Styles is trembling. "You're okay. I know it's dark in here, but you're okay." Styles buries his face into Derek's shoulder and tries to calm down. Just talk to me," he whispers. "Don't let me forget I'm not alone." "Okay," Derek says, "you're not alone. I'm here with you." He starts telling Styles about the painting he's working on, the last one he sold, the things he wants to do with his gallery. Gradually, the panic eases, but Styles knows that it's going to come back, and the longer they're in this truck, the worse it's going to get. All he can do is hold on. Victoria has to leave a message for Vanessa, and while they're waiting for her to call back, Deaton and Scott get on the road. "Be safe," Allison tells Scott, and hugs him for a long minute. After some consideration, she sends Isaac and Mac to go check on Jake and Phil. She doesn't want anybody thinking that they're not being well protected. The pack feels spread thin to her, and she's uncomfortable with it, even if it wasn't their adversary's goal. There's not much she can do about it. But in retrospect, she wishes they had split evenly, and that Lydia or Boyd had stayed with her. She supposes one more person really wouldn't make a difference if something happened. And who knows what's going on with Styles? He might need them. Chris takes a mid-afternoon nap and wakes up confused and disoriented. It takes Victoria almost an hour to get him calmed down again. She has to start back at the beginning and tell him everything that happened over and over again. Allison texts with Scott and keeps trying to call Styles and the others, just in case. Victoria's phone rings just as they're discussing who's going to sleep at the clinic and who isn't. The answer is that everybody is going to sleep at the clinic. Victoria thinks that Allison should go somewhere with a real bed, but she's staunchly refusing. She picks it up and says, "Hello, Aunt Vanessa. Thank you for calling me back. Do you mind if I put you on speaker? Allison and Chris are here." The response she must get is affirmative, because she taps the screen on her phone and then sets it down, saying, "Thanks." "What's going on, Vicky?" Vanessa asks, in the brusque, harsh tone that Allison was now used to. Vanessa always gives the impression of being angry, even though she rarely is. "Can I tell you about something and have it be in confidence?" Victoria asks. Vanessa grunts. "I can keep a secret." "Okay. We've come under attack here. Chris's cousin Henry is working with a sorcerer. I don't want to go into a lot of detail. To make a long story short, Styles and half his pack got on a plane to go confront Henry and see if they can find out who he's working with. Only the plane never made it. It crashed in Utah."
"Jesus, Vicky," Vanessa says. "Any survivors?"
"We're not sure," Victoria says, her voice still calm and even. "No bodies were found beyond the pilot. The officials said it looked like a controlled crash landing, so there's a good chance that the werewolves would have been able to walk away. They didn't find a lot of blood or body parts or anything like that. But there's been no sign of Styles or any of his pack."
"If they crashed in Utah, it could take them days to walk to civilization," Vanessa says. "There's a hell of a lot of empty miles up there."
"I know," Victoria says. "But there's every appearance that the plane was sabotaged. Our fear is that whoever did that knew approximately where they were going to land and picked them up while they were still dazed from the crash."
"Likely enough. What do you need from me?"
"Well," Victoria says, "it occurred to us that if someone was going to crash a plane in northern Utah and wanted to take their abductees somewhere secure, your family's prison might leap to mind. Aria was pretty angry the last time she saw us. She might be involved."
"Ugh,"
Vanessa says, more of an auditory grimace than anything else.
"She's not. At least, I don't think so."
"That's not good enough, Aunt Vanessa. People are missing, possibly hurt."
"Yeah," Vanessa sighs. "Look, confidence goes both ways, okay? Aria isn't well. She's been in and out of the hospital for the last couple months. Doesn't want anyone to know. You know how she is. But she's almost 80, for Christ's sake. Even if she doesn't want to admit it. First, it was just the flu, right? But then it turned into pneumonia. She was in the hospital for 3 weeks, and she hasn't been the same since then. She had to go back twice. First because of shortness of breath, and then again because she passed out and fell. We thought she might have broken her hip, although she didn't, thank God. Anyway, they think she's had at least one mild heart attack in the past that we didn't even know about because, of course, she never sees a doctor."
"I'm sorry," Victoria says.
"Yeah, thanks." Vanessa brushes this off. "Anyway, I don't think she would have had time to coordinate something like this. And I've been with her more often than not."
Allison leans forward. "Does she have any children? Who else has access to the prison?"
"She's got 2 kids, yeah," Vanessa says. "Katerina married one of the Winchesters, and we haven't seen her in years. And Malcolm is responsible for the hunters in Colorado, so he's pretty busy most of the time and doesn't really care about this stuff. But none of that means Aria didn't talk to someone else about the prison before she got sick. Or that one of the people who runs the place didn't decide to rent the damn thing out if Henry Argent offered him a big enough payday."
"Well, we need to check it out, and if Styles is there, get him the hell out," Allison says. Vanessa's quiet for a minute.
"I can't tell you where it is," she finally says.
When Allison protests, she says,
"I'm sorry, Allison, but I just can't. Aria would kill me. Literally. But I will ask some questions and go check it out. I'm in Colorado myself right now. Malcolm was having trouble with a nasty batch of red caps. But I'll be back there as soon as I can. If Styles is being held there, I promise you that I will make sure he and the rest of his pack get released unharmed. It's the best I can do for you, Vicky."
"I'll take it," Victoria says.
We have some other plans in motion, so if anything develops, I'll let you know. Allison is quiet, deep in thought, as Victoria says goodbye and hangs up the phone. After a minute, she looks up and says,
I need to go talk to a few people. Will you be all right here without me?
We'll be fine, honey, Victoria says, and she doesn't ask what Allison is planning. Allison goes out to the car and thinks over her options for a few long minutes before calling Scott.
Hey, babe, where are you?
She asks. An hour east of Reno, he says. You okay?
Yeah,
she says, and explains what's happened so far. I was thinking about how else we might find that facility. Vanessa's not going to tell us where it is, and it could be days before you and Dr. Deaton get close enough to find them with magic. Somebody must know where it is, right? And I think I might know who. Scott's blank silence shows that he hasn't yet boarded her train of thought.
Okay. Who?
Ian.
That shape-shifting monster from the Conclave? Scott asks, surprised.
Yeah, he was in one of the prisons, remember? We know it wasn't the Gutierrez prison because we've seen all their records. So there's a 50-50 shot that it was either the one in Wyoming or the one in Vermont. And I bet it was the one in Wyoming. Agnes St. James seemed to be the one who was responsible for selecting him, and she's friends with my great-aunt Aria.
Okay, Scott says. Yeah, I guess he might know, but we can't exactly trust him.
I know, but we've got to do something. I can't just sit here. Do you think we could get in touch with him?
Well, Scott says, thinking. He wrote Styles all those postcards and stuff. I think he put an email address on them sometimes, telling Styles to write him. Though I don't think Styles ever did. You might be able to find it. Styles is such a pack rat, he keeps everything.
Where do you think they might be? Allison asks.
I don't have any idea, Scott says, but I bet Papa Stalinsky will.
Somehow, and Styles has no idea how, Styles manages to keep the panic at bay. He has two minor panic attacks, but Derek soothes them away both times. He hates everything about where he currently is. He hates the smell and the darkness and the way he's cramped up into such a tiny space. And most of all, he hates the fact that he keeps thinking about the trunk of Peter's car. But he's not alone. Derek is here with him. So every time his heartbeat starts to ramp up and his breath starts to whistle in his throat, Derek rubs his hands over Styles' back, murmurs comforting things into his ears. Styles doesn't really fall asleep, but he slides into a half-doze and pictures the birch grove in his mind. It won't do a goddamn bit of good, but he really feels like yelling at Peter right now.
This is all your fault,
he snaps when Peter appears. Peter grimaces.
I suppose I can't argue with that.
Styles
feels the panic closing in again. He forces himself to take a deep breath.
I fucking hate being closed in. You're a smart asshole. Fix this.
Peter lets out a sigh.
I would truly love to oblige you, he says, but I don't really see how. You're trapped in a magical block of stone. If Derek isn't strong enough to physically break it, your options are pretty much nil. Your only choice would be to try to get away once it opens.
Some help you are,
Styles mutters, and Peter shrugs.
I'm going to find out who this sorcerer is, and I'm going to put my foot up their ass.
Well, until then, you might as well get some rest, Peter says, and disappears.
Styles groans into Derek's shoulder, and when Derek asks what's wrong, he says,
Your uncle's a fucking dick.
And Derek doesn't argue. Styles just curls tighter. There's basically no room to do anything besides curl up in Derek's arms, so he might as well own it. About an hour later, he thinks it's been an hour. He hopes it's been an hour. His legs start to cramp up. He's beginning to realize that wherever they're going, it's not close. He tries to stretch, but his arms and legs both hit the walls of their cage. A frustrated whine escapes him.
Hey, you're okay,
Derek says. But Styles isn't okay, and he doesn't know how Derek can say that. He hurts, and it's dark, and he's frightened, and he isn't the legendary boy in red in here. He's 16 and scared, and he wants out. He's slamming his fists against the walls while Derek tries to restrain him without hurting him, screaming to be let out without being aware of what he's saying.
Shh,
Derek soothes as his screams dissolve into hysterical sobs. Derek holds him, but he can't stop crying. He wants out so badly that he can't think about anything else. He can't breathe. He feels like he's suffocating. Gradually, the worst of it passes. The hysterics eventually peter out, more from exhaustion than from anything else. He lets out a few more hitching sobs and goes silent. Derek just keeps holding him, rocking him as much as their limited space will allow. Hours pass. He drifts and dozes, though he never really sleeps. Every time he falls asleep enough to lose track of his surroundings, he jolts awake with the panic back in his throat. He has no idea how much time has gone by when the truck finally rolls to a stop. A few minutes later, the earth dissolves around him. He flails around like a landed fish, trying to get his limbs back in order, and fails entirely. The back of the truck is yanked open, and he's dragged out by his elbows before he can even think about trying to escape. There's a quick bite of cold air, a flash of light, and then he's inside, being dragged down a hallway. It's wide enough for six people to walk abreast, but it's dim and damp, constructed of concrete and stone. He wonders if they're going underground, but there's no slope in either direction. A quick glance over his shoulder reveals that Derek is being dragged along with him, that it's taking six men to keep him down, but the six men are succeeding. The tunnel is about 50 feet long. Then they come out into what looks much more like a hospital wing, smooth linoleum floors and inoffensively pastel walls. The scent of disinfectant permeates everything, and he feels his heartbeat ramp up. He hates hospitals. Derek is dragged in a different direction and puts up such a fight at being separated that Styles can hear him howling for several minutes afterwards. They take two corners, and then he's shown through what looks like a solid steel door. The room he's put in reminds him of nothing so much as a dentist's office. A large chair in the middle with a light overhead, a counter and a sink and some cupboards. He's shoved into the chair, manhandled onto his back, still trying to struggle as they get him strapped down. He tries to wrestle free, but it gets him absolutely nowhere. His body isn't really moving quite the way he wants it to. He's reminded, suddenly, viciously, of some of his past exploits when his body has been pushed too far and given up. "Get a line in him," a crisp female voice says. "He's dehydrated." "No shit," he wants to say. "I just walked across half the desert," he wants to say. He's fairly sure they were in the truck most of the night, but all that comes out is another croak and a little flail as they get an IV started. He drifts for a little while. He's too weak to really do much of anything. Gradually, the saline drip starts to revive him. He realizes that he's alone in the room and starts working at the restraints again. He's gotten exactly nowhere with them when the door opens and a woman walks in. She's fairly short and thin, definitely human, and has brown hair swept back into a tight bun and wire-rimmed glasses. "Hey, nice to meet you," Styles says, when she doesn't immediately address him, but instead sets down a clipboard and a small device that looks like a recorder or microphone. "Thanks for the saline. Perked me right up. What are the odds that I can get a cheeseburger?" She doesn't reply. Instead, she begins to dictate into her recorder. "Subject is a 20-year-old male, currently the only known human alpha in existence. The purpose of these experiments is to judge to what extent being the alpha affects him physically. The benefits of lycanthropy fall into four categories: strength, speed, endurance, and healing ability."
She continues to study Styles with a clinical gaze that makes him extremely nervous. Subject currently has bruising on his face and chest, most likely related to the plane crash that occurred 24 hours previous. We can therefore deduce that the effects of his alphahood on his healing ability are minimal. We will continue to monitor these physical injuries. She walks over to a cabinet and begins to look through one of the drawers, still dictating. Speed testing is not recommended for obvious reasons.
No, I'd love to give you a demonstration of my speed, Styles says.
Totally. The woman ignores him. So we will begin with endurance testing. She gestures to the two men who have been waiting in the doorway, who come over to free Styles from the restraints. When Styles attempts to get away, one of them prods his ribs with a stun gun. He recognizes it as the kind Chris uses, and sometimes Allison, that carries voltage far above the legal limit. High enough to stun a werewolf, and probably enough to kill him. He decides to stop struggling. They want to test his endurance? He can do that. As long as they're doing experiments on him, they're not killing him. And the longer he's in one place, the higher the odds that his pack will find him. They're looking. His father is the best detective he knows, and Allison is smart as a whip. The others are no slouches either. They'll find him. He just has to hold out until then. It's somewhat discomforting when he finds himself thrown into a room that's nothing more than bare concrete, with what looks like a hole in the floor. It's a well, he realizes. Not large enough to call a pool. About 5 square feet. Enough room to tread water, but not really enough to swim. They strip his clothes off and shove him in. The cold hits him like a physical shock, and he gasps and sputters, flailing. The walls are smooth concrete. There's nothing he can grasp. He tries to get his feet against one wall and his shoulders against the other, to try to walk up the side. But it's about a foot too wide. There's nothing he can do except tread water. So that's what he does. And does. And does. His muscles, already sore from the plane crash and stiff from the extended confinement, begin to complain almost immediately. The cold only makes it worse, making his joints lock up and groan. He forces them to comply. Then he realizes something. These people are testing his endurance. They aren't going to let him drown. When he stops treading water and goes under, they'll assume he's exhausted and pull him back out. He does some sputtering to make it look more realistic, then gradually allows himself to sink. He counts in his head, holding his breath. The water is inky black and he can't see anything. 10 seconds pass. 15. 20. His lungs start to ache. 30 seconds. 45. At a full minute, his head breaks the water and he gasps for air, splashing around and trying to regain his bearings. He allows himself to sink again, but panics almost immediately, flailing and sputtering. Then he starts treading water again. 10 minutes later, he tries again. The same thing happens, so he keeps paddling. He wonders if the others can feel his physical distress and panic. He wonders what his father is doing, if they found the wreckage of the plane, if they think he's dead. He wonders what's going to happen when he finally runs out of steam. Eventually, it happens. He just can't hold himself up any longer. He grasps helplessly at the sides and gradually sinks below the surface. He holds his breath, holds it and holds it and holds it until he finally can't anymore. And he's dragged out of the water just as he takes a breath. He coughs and sputters, collapsing onto his side on the concrete, water coming out of what feels like every orifice. He's so tired that he can't even glare at the woman who's dictating into her stupid little recorder. Subject completed endurance test 1 with a time of 3 hours and 16 minutes, which is approximately 1 standard deviation above the human mean, but 2 standard deviations below the werewolf mean. She clicks off her recorder, then turns it back on and adds, "We will now verify the accuracy of this test." Styles is wondering what the hell that means, and thinking about how little he likes the sound of it, while the guards scoop him up and drag him into another room. It's about the size of a gymnasium. They dump him just inside with no restraints. The woman in the lab coat just watches him for a minute. Then a guard comes in carrying a tray that has a steak on it, as well as a basket of rolls and some vegetables. There's a can of Coke on the tray, too. Styles stares at it, yearns for it, as he sets it down about 50 yards away. He wants it so badly that he crawls towards it, even knowing that he's just playing along with the woman's experiments. But he can't make it. He barely crawls for 4 seconds before he collapses and just has to breathe for a few minutes. When he hears a loud noise, he realizes that he passed out. One of the men picks him up again, but the woman with the lab coat is gone. "Can I have the food now?" Styles asks, making an effort to sound pitiful. But the man says nothing. He's carried back to his original room and strapped into the chair. Then the man leaves. The room is empty. Styles ponders his options for approximately 2 seconds before he passes out.